on weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Well, big thanks to Emma, Roz and Graham for driving us through the afternoon. It's Tuesday the 19th of November. You're listening to Game On with Ruby Walsh alongside Damien O'Mara. And coming up between now and the new music show with Bette De Silva at 7pm, we'll hear from Kerry legend Jack O'Shea on the news of Dublin great Brian Fenton retiring from inter-county football.
Plenty of boxing chat to come as well. Kevin Byrne will talk headbutts, buffering and bringing Katie Taylor home for her next fight. In soccer, Mark Langdon will set up the Nations League night ahead, while in rugby, Michael Corcoran has been chatting to the Irish scrum coach John Fogarty about Ireland's discipline and straight talking. As always, if you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552. You can WhatsApp 087 187 9200 or we are on X at Game On 2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Damien O'Mara, how are you?
Ruby, how are you? Long time no speak.
No speak is right. Damien, we had the experts last night. We had Keane Tracy and Stephen Ferris, but you're a keen rugby man.
Well, now, go
What's
on.
What's your take?
My take is, I thought some
As
of the reaction
fan,
to the opening game.
Fan.
The discipline is a massive problem. Like, we are throwing matches away by virtue of the fact that we're not conceding that many tries, but we are just gifting good teams too many opportunities from the boot. I don't really subscribe to this thing that there's a crisis or there's a blip or that we're, you know, suddenly facing into the collapse of the Irish rugby team. I do think there was an awful lot of pressure on them on Friday night, and you could see that, like, to be there, and like, I'm lucky enough to be doing the interviews for Radio 1, and it's only when you get to read the body language of guys that you've spent some time, not necessarily in the company of, but at proximity to, that you could realise just how het up they were on Friday. So I wouldn't be worrying massively, but I think they're going to have to drive on and win these two games not to give people an opportunity to be asking questions about them.
What about the job Joe Schmidt is doing with Australia, though?
Yeah, but then can you read an awful lot into last weekend when you look at the job that Warren Gatland's doing with Wales? And I mean that I don't mean that to be disrespectful. And I know that there's few things that Irish rugby fans like more than to get stuck into Warren Gatland. But, like, you know, Wales are a disaster.
I know that, but look at Australia's other results in this autumn series and think about where they were 12 months
ago. Yeah, and listen, Joe has done a phenomenal job in terms of, like, you know, was it over 50 players were called into camp, and they've got an A team travelling off in one place and they've got the main team somewhere else, and he's obviously decided this is a 4-year project. Like, is there something about the Southern Hemisphere that they talk about these 4-year projects? Because even, like, you know, to chat to some of the people involved in the Argentinian Union on Friday night, they were talking about how they'd had this great rugby championship, they'd taken all these scalps, they wanted to win in Dublin for the first time, but the whole thing kept coming back to, it's not a bad position to be in year one post Rugby World Cup. So,
yeah,
you know, is the Six Nations so important from either a prestige or a financial point of view to the unions in this part of the world that we put everything into that because we have to? Whereas maybe the Southern Hemisphere teams go, well, actually, no, it's all about where is the next Rugby World Cup? Wherever the next Rugby World Cup is in 2020, whatever, you know?
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Anyway, we will have Corky and John Fogarty a little bit later in the show. Maybe they'll delve into it a bit more.
Surely Joe Schmidt will get a very warm reception in Dublin, won't he?
I'd say he will. But I actually would think it's of more relevance for Australia with a Lions tour coming next summer.
But listen, that's the problem.
6 months ago, they were facing obliteration. At least now, they might give the Lions a game.
Yeah, and the problem, well, again, I'm going to sound very cynical with bringing everything back to money. I've spent too much time reading Miguel Delaney's book lately, whereas everything's about money and prestige and, you know, image and everything else. Like, the Lions TV deal will keep, you know, the Australian Union going for quite some time. But in terms of public interest, if the Lions were to go out and hammer them in the opening two tests, like, it's ominous. Yeah. So, yeah. Are you a fan of the Lions as a concept?
I am, as a concept. Maybe because I grew up as a child and you're watching, you're hoping maybe an Irish player can get on a Lions team. Obviously, in the last couple of tours, we've had plenty. But, yeah, I am. I think it's novel. Providing the competition is sufficient.
That's the key thing.
Yeah, and it looks like being. Obviously, when they go to New Zealand, they went to South Africa, it's back in Australia. You're hoping the competition will be sufficient. I do. I mean, to look at some of the great players playing together, I don't know. I just think there's something magical about it.
Yeah, a couple of news stories. We're going to come to the Brian Fenton bombshell. Was it a bombshell?
31, possibly. Fit, hard, But like, when you look at it, still 10 years at the top, and Jack O'Shea will show some light in that. It's some career. But I think he started in 2015, like 21 years of age.
Yeah. I don't know that it's a bombshell. And listen, so that's James McCarthy and Brian Fenton out the door. I think there's going to be two or three more that'll probably join him, but we might talk to Jack about that in a second. Listen, we rugby news, we're going to hear, as mentioned, from John Fogarty later. Tyke Furlong fit, Ryan Baird ruled out of this weekend. Discipline is the big talking point. Big win for Scotland last night in the Nations League. And the big story today, Conor Nyland winning the William Hill Sportsbook of the Year. Which, are you into sportsbooks?
I do like sportsbooks, like, and I've had to read more since I started doing this show, Damien, but I haven't read Conor Nyland.
But when you look, oh, it's brilliant. When you look back through the William Hill, like Thomas Hauser's book on Muhammad Ali, Paul Kimmage's book, Rough Ride, Simon Cooper's Football Against the Enemy, Donald McRae had a phenomenal book, Dark Trade, about boxing, that they are books that like stand the test of time. And maybe it's a lazy thing that when people go, oh, the greatest sports books of all time, hang on, I'll Google such and such.
What's the best one you read?
The best sports book I've ever read, or just the best of the William Hill winners? The book that has stuck with me the longest is Donald McRae, who I've mentioned there, has a book called, I'm going to get this wrong, In Sunshine or in Shadow, how boxing, it's basically about boxing and the troubles. And it's how boxing coaches in Northern Ireland used the sport to unite the communities, and how boxing managed to unify people at a time that there was virtually nothing else in Northern Ireland society that would unify people. So that for me is one that really sticks out. So Donald McRae brought that out a couple of years ago. But like Agassi's book is brilliant. I think Conor Nyland's book is phenomenal. But like, it's like, it's hard to contextualise for people. Like that's like winning Best Actor or Best Film at the Oscars, because that is the level that people put into the William Hill. And it's been a pretty good year for the William Hill. There's a book about Afghan women's football, which was the one that was tipped to win it, which I admit I haven't read. But it's $30,000, nice prize, and a nice trophy to go to. Did you enjoy the autobiography experience?
No.
So you, who did yours with you?
Mikey Clarkin did it with me. He was exceptional. I'd say I was shocking. No, I didn't enjoy it one bit.
Why so?
I'm more comfortable talking about other people and other things than I am about myself.
And the problem with all of these things is you can talk about all your King Georges, and you can talk about everything that you've done and the trophies that are all over the house, but people want a bit of gossip, don't they? And like there is that pressure to have the, like, you know, no, you have to have something in there. Like, sorry, the perception is you have to have something in there that people go, oh, well, Ruby Walsh has spoken about his addiction to Mars bars and whatever. I'm trying not to say something that's going to end up in the High Court, you know. So,
yeah, no, I did. I thought Agassi's book was exceptional. I must say, I thought Paul McGreed, Tom McGrath's even was an incredible read. And Michael Holding, Why We Kneel and How We Rise.
Which is brilliant. I'd forgotten about that, which I also think won the William Hill.
Yeah, that's an exceptional read.
Okay, brilliant. Right, well, we get stuck into our first guest.
Ah, sure, we might as well.
I'll let you give him the big sell.
He wrote an autobiography. Jack O'Shea, I never read your book. Did you write one?
No, Ruby, I was too cute like you to have to do that.
No, I did write it, but it was too cute to say it.
No, well, the only thing about you, Ruby, is the horses couldn't talk back to you.
No, that's true, Jack. That is true. But, Jack, we're here not to talk about you. Maybe we should. Maybe we'll get you on someone right to talk all about you, so we'll rob your autobiography out of you. But we're here to talk about Brian Fenton. Magician of a midfielder, an incredible man, 7 All-Irelands, 10 Leinster medals. He was a rock in the middle of the pitch, for Dublin.
Yeah, he was a fabulous player and a fabulous person. You know, I suppose it's a bit of a bombshell, really, that I didn't expect it this morning when I woke up and seen the news that he had retired. I wasn't expecting that, because he's a player who has been phenomenal for 10 years, who hasn't carried any injury, which is phenomenal as well. And ironic, Ruby, he's retired on my birthday, which is ironic.
Happy birthday, Jack.
Happy birthday, yeah. 67 today, so Brian retired on my birthday. So he's a player I've been admired for the years. He's a fabulous person. His dad is a fabulous man. Of course, he was a fantastic Kerry supporter when we were playing. And I suppose, Ruby, just know the bit of Kerryness in him doesn't do him any harm either, but he was a phenomenal player, player who I probably seen about, I'd say, 97-98% of his matches in Croke Park and playing for Dublin. And every day I went to watch him, I admired him. And just, you know, you couldn't but, you know, admire the excellence of his play, of his movement, of his involvement in the game, of his behaviour. Everything that is good about Gaelic football, Brian Fenton had it.
All those things you've mentioned, how hard is it for Desi Farrell going to find someone to put into that jersey?
You don't get players like that every day. You know, he's a player of a generation. His whole demeanour on the pitch, you know, is very hard. I remember actually meeting my big Dublin opposition man, I suppose, Brian Mullins, back in, I think it was 2014, and out in Belfield one day, and he's saying to me that he that there's this young fella coming, he says, and he reminds me a lot of you, he said to me, and he said, this fella's going to be good and just watch out for him. And that person was Brian Fenton. So, you know, Brian was a great judge of footballers and that, and he knew at that very young, good age, because he was going through college at that time with UCD and that, and he could see his potential. And but you don't become a great footballer or a great jockey like yourself, Ruby. You know, you have to put in the work, and obviously Brian Fenton put in unbelievable work over the years to get to where he was, to get to the fitness levels he's been in, and to demand the respect that he got from all the other players all over the country.
The thing about this as well, Jack, is he is one of those players that when he turned up, Dublin turned up, and you got a sense that he was almost like a dressing room general, that he was someone who held everyone else to very, very high standards.
Well, he had that in all respects, with his height and with his strength and his power, and you could see it, like, he, you know, he never wasted a ball, really. You know, it's just very, you could count in one hand the amount of mistakes he might make in a game, but as you say, he was pivotal to everything Dublin did. He, you know, when they got into trouble, he was the one that took them out of trouble. And as his career went on, as you know, you could see his influence in the Dublin team over the years. And when it came to tight matches, he was the one that stood up and kind of, he always performed, Damien. And that's important about any player. You know, when the need is greatest, your greatest comes to the top, and the cream comes to the top. And he was that for Dublin.
It has the potential, though, to be quite the junction in the road for this Dublin panel. McCarthy gone, Fenton gone. People will look at Cluxton, Fitzsimons, and one or two of the others. That all of a sudden, Desi Farrell might have the mother and father of rebuilding jobs on his hands.
Yeah, well, it happens. Everybody, it happened to our team back in the 70s and 80s. You know, a lot of the lads went at the same time, and it happened to us probably back in 82. We got beaten by Offaly, and a good few lads retired around that time after that, and then it took us a couple of years to get our feet back again. I've no doubt that there's huge talent in Dublin, and there's huge resources to bring new players forward. And, you know, sometimes when players go like that, I mean, you know, it opens the door for somebody else. And I have no doubt that there's plenty of talent within Dublin, but you don't replace the likes of Brian Fenton overnight. It takes a good few years to dig up a player again at that calibre and that stature. And Desi is going to have a bit of work in his hands, but you know, I suppose it's revolving, football revolves, and you have to get on with it. And you know, you have to set your seeds again. There's two great players. The two probably players that have gone now this year probably have been the two most consistent players Dublin have had over the last 10 years. And, you know, it's going to be very hard to replace them.
But that's probably it, Jack, isn't it? 10 years is a huge commitment at the level these lads are playing at. And he's won 7 All-Irelands, 10 Leinsters. I'm not saying there's no motivation to it, but you look at it and think, there's 10 years of my life. I've achieved as much as I can. I'm going while the going is good.
Yeah, I played on for 17 years, you know, which is a long, long time as well. And it's just that he has had 10 phenomenal years. There's a lot more games involved now in the game today, and there's a lot more, you know, with backdoor games and all different kinds of competitions or whatever it is, that there's huge demands, you know, the amount of training has changed so much, the game has revolved so much, that there's a huge demand on that. Now, I don't know what's the reason why Brian is gone, but, you know, I'm sure he has given this a lot of thought, because to me, he's still at his powers, and he's still one of the greatest players in the country at the moment, and the best players in the country at the moment. And whatever he does and does in the future, you know, I wish him the best. And I've been have great contact with him over the years, and we've been good friends and had good chats when we meet up and that. And he's an inspiration person to talk to and meet up with as well. So he has given huge commitment. 10 years is an awful long time of your life, particularly that it takes 4 or 5 nights a week now to be involved with a county team and that. So, you know, we have to respect his decision and wish him the best.
Jack, he tells the story of your number popping up on his phone after he won Footballer of the Year and what that meant to him. So, like, listen, the obvious question is, where would you put him in the pantheon of the greats that you've seen over your lifetime? But, like, you see the type of player, if you could roll the years back, Jack O'Shea at his prime would want Brian Fenton at his prime alongside him.
That would be a dream for me to come through, you know, to be compared with Brian and with Brian Mullins as well, and, you know, all the players of the present day. He's an exceptional player, and as I said, you know, I just thought it would be nice if I just compliment him and get his second Player of the Year award, which he thought deserved at the time I told him that. And as I said, when we've met up, we've had some nice conversations together. Mm. And I know he goes to Kerry a lot as well. He spends a lot of time down there in Kerry. So, you know, but he's a player that's kind of looked up at from everybody all over the country. And I think there'll be a lot of Dublin supporters tonight are very sad to see that he's not won't be representing Dublin again. But there's a lot of people all over the country as well will be disappointed they won't see him display his talents in Croke Park again. So, you know, you have to salute him for what he has done, and he's had an unbelievable career, and you know, I wish him the best in the future.
Does modesty mean your skin crawls when people talk about you as one of the greatest of all time, or the greatest of all time? Like, are you comfortable with that type of conversation?
Well, that's up to other people, Damien. It's up to them to make that kind of decision. But to be compared with the great players, it is nice, of course. Yeah, you know, you know the work you put in over the years, what you've achieved over the years, and you know, it's up to other people to decide who's the best, or who's this, or who's that. But it's nice to be up there. Yeah.
Before we let you go, obviously we've Central Council to come, and we've had Special Congress to come. Are you excited about the prospect of what football might look like in 2025?
I don't know, actually, Damien. I think the jury is out still. I think, you know, that teams are going to have to learn to play with these rules. I think it might change the face of football a bit. There's a few rules that are exciting, and you know, but I do feel that managers are going to try to counteract, you know, and not be conceding 2 points of scores and conceding goals and that sort of stuff. So it'll be interesting to see. I think there might be a problem down the line at club level, that some of these rules to be introduced might be a bit hard at different clubs, you know, down along third and fourth divisions and counties and that. But I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, I think that realistically the game needs a lift. The game had been gone very boring and very stature and that, and I think we needed to get more contest into the game, and I'm hoping that these rules will bring in more contest between players, and that we'll see more fielding and more traditional football.
And would you have a worry that the changes might be the thing that are inspiring fellas at this stage in their career to maybe think, I don't need to reinvent the wheel, maybe it's time to pack the bag and head off into the sunset?
I don't think so. You know, okay. I think they're individual decisions by players, you know, when they want to retire, when they want to give up. And I think this, it's good. Like James McCarthy kind of went in his own terms, and Brian is going his own terms now. There's nothing that they haven't achieved, and that they have, you know, there's nothing that they haven't gone out and put the hard work in and got rewarded for. So, you know, I don't think that'd be there, because, you know, if you're involved in a county team and a county panel and it's great to be involved in. It's exciting, you know, it's an exciting time of your life and that. And I think it's hard to let it go as well. So I can't see them letting it go too easily. But I was just surprised with the retirement of Brian, yeah.
Well, we're delighted to have you, Jack O'Shea, to come on to talk about him. From one great speaking about another, thank you ever so much. Enjoy the rest of your evening. We're going to take a quick break, Damien.
We will indeed. Back with boxing in 2 minutes.
Game on.
Boxing. History made again.
Oh my gosh.
Do you want from professional boxing?
Simply incredible.
Wow. Round three judges. See the contest 95-94. Declaring your winner by unanimous decision.
You cannot take anything away from Katie Taylor and her legacy, but my God!
But I think I definitely landed the bigger punches tonight, especially the second half of the fight, and that's actually what won me to fight in the end, I feel. But you're right, another really close fight. Two epic fights, two very close decisions, and I'm just proud to be part of such another huge night for women's boxing. But yeah, two very, very different different fights, I think.
Katie, congratulations again. Madison Square Garden, obviously you had all the Irish fans there, not so many in the arena tonight. How much does it mean to you to know you had the support of everyone back home in Ireland, your family as well, and how will it feel to come back to Ireland for Christmas, especially with the belts again?
Oh, amazing. I'm just super grateful for the support of and from the Irish people back as an amateur boxer to now. So I'm just so proud to be an Irish woman and to be representing such a great nation, and to be going home again for Christmas with all the belts and still undisputed champion. That's very, very sweet.
Two epic fights, two close fights, two victories for Katie Taylor. But Kevin Byrne, it didn't sound like Texas agreed.
Sorry, I just missed your question there, Ruby.
It didn't sound like Texas agreed with the judges.
It didn't, no. Were they booing the decision or were they booing Katie Taylor, which would be highly offensive, I'm sure, to her fans. Certainly a lot of people, by the sound of it, in the arena didn't agree with the commentary. A lot of Americans are like flooding the timelines on social media, still giving out to this day about the way the decision went. It was a close fight, and I don't think any close fight can be labelled a robbery. Taylor has her backers, Serrano has her backers, and I guess the only solution is to do it again. But having rewatched the fight myself, no commentary, I think Taylor was the rightful winner, Ruby.
That's the next question I was going to ask you, and that's not with green glasses on. That's just cold, hard, independent, watching it without commentary. You felt she outscored. How hard is it to win in an arena like that when the fans were all with Serrano? Everything was against her, yet the judges went for her. That's hard.
Yeah, Taylor was up against absolutely everything in this contest. There was already the perception that Serrano was hard done by in the first fight, so any success was going to be possibly rewarded to maybe right the wrong instead of the trilogy fight. This fight was also promoted by her promotional company, MVP Promotions, spearheaded by Jake Paul, who kind of put on the event against Mike Tyson. It was in America, Serrano's home nation, two American judges and a Canadian. Everything was going against Taylor. Not a happy hunting ground, Texas, for Irish boxers in the past. I think back to Andy Lee's world title fight against Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. a decade ago, when a lot of things went against them inside and outside the ring. Very difficult place for Taylor to go and defend her titles, but she went in and she put on a performance. Go on.
Okay. Looking at it from a purely boxing point of view, where do you think Katie Taylor won it?
I think she was disciplined. I think her will to win, which came out during the very tight rounds. But I think she was more strategic than Serrano. I think she'd made better adjustments. That was the verdict of, I was speaking to Roy Jones Jr. about this fight the other day. That was his verdict, that Taylor made better adjustments since the first fight. And she was more strategic in her punching. By that, I mean, she was willing to kind of back off and bring Serrano onto her. And she was allowing Serrano to punch her way in and miss a lot of shots and then kind of and tag her on the way in. That's risky because you're keeping just enough a distance for Serrano to miss her punches and then step in. And when you're trying to land yours, you're going to get hit as well. We saw that in the first round. That was a round that Taylor was coasting towards the first round. And in the last 5 seconds, she got hit with a big left hand and staggered back to the ropes. And that was one of the very few rounds in the fight that the judges all agreed, and they all unanimously gave it to Serrano. The rest of the fight was more nip and tuck. They agreed on round 6, they agreed on round 8. Every other round was, the judges were 2 this way, 1 the other. So it was very, very tight margins. But I felt that Taylor was more disciplined, had a better game plan for Serrano. And I felt that some of Serrano's game plan was quite lacking. She was obviously cut. The cut was a huge factor in the fight. She was cut in the fourth round, clash of heads. The cut opened up. Taylor was really good at targeting then the cut and opening it up even more. She was quite ruthless in this approach, slashing left hooks off the cut all for the rest of the evening after the cut opened. And I felt that Serrano was a little bit misguided in her corner. Now, I know they're going to be shocked at seeing the extent of the cut. It's not often a fighter will go on and continue after such a bad one, but she did. I just felt that instead of being told how to go out and attack Taylor and how to counter her, she was more being told, watch the head. And that kind of ignores the good work Taylor was doing with her hands, if you get me.
And then, again, Kevin, speaking objectively, like, there's been so much focus, and Serrano has reined back on her initial comments and criticisms of Katie, but there has been so much focus on Katie's stance, and is this an issue where she does have a tendency to lead with the head, or she does have a tendency for her head to be prominent?
I mean, it's part of her defence, right? You know, she steps back and then she jumps in to take her shots. So when you're stepping back, and then you're crouching and you're coming in to take your shots. Also, Katie Taylor's an orthodox puncher. Serrano's a lefty, a southpaw. So that's going to lend itself to a few clashes ahead. I don't know if she's entirely innocent in this. Only Taylor can say. Like, I'm sure her will to win and her willingness to get down and dirty and scrap for every single point in a fight is also there. So, you know, you do what it takes. I don't think she's a dirty fighter, as has been the accusation that's been leveled at her by the Team Serrano. I think she will do what it takes to win. You know, their heads came together. How much of it was purposeful from Katie Taylor? She was sanctioned for it. You know, she was, a point was taken off, and she ended up being only the victor by 1 point in the fight. So she was sanctioned for use of the head. I'm not sure what more Serrano's team would have wanted for her to be thrown out of the fight, possibly, but that would have been incredibly harsh.
But let's be very honest, it sows the seed now for another bout between the pair.
Massively, and I suppose Serrano rowing back as well from her comments does too. We've seen 20 rounds of excellence between these two fighters. The momentum has swung this way and that way, and I think everybody would be willing to see it again. Taylor is obviously 2-0 in this fight, but there's a lot of people, there's respected voices around the world that feel that, you know, Serrano was the rightful winner twice, let alone once. And then there's plenty of people that feel that Taylor won. Like, Taylor won even the last, and even her great rival as the pound-for-pound champion, Clarissa Shields, said afterwards, Taylor won that fight. Some of the top American boxers like Shakur Stevenson, Terence Crawford, Roy Jones Jr. on commentary, they feel that Taylor was the rightful winner. So the whole thing about robbery is hyperbole, really, and I think it's kind of brought on by the commentators. But that being said, while Taylor is 2-0 against Amanda Serrano, I'd willingly watch them fight again a third time.
Where and when?
They could do it anywhere, really. Like, they could go back to Madison Square Garden. Taylor has a couple of ambitions left in her career, I believe, and one of them is to fight at Croke Park and the other is to fight at Las Vegas. So if that fight could be made in Las Vegas, I'm sure it would be something that would appeal to Katie Taylor. Much of the big fights have gone out of Las Vegas these days. You saw this one took place in Texas. Saudi Arabia hosts so many of the big fights these days. Could Taylor Serrano 3 end up in Riyadh? Could end up in Croke Park? That's all to be played for in the summer. Her promoter, Eddie Hearn, has been unsuccessful so far in a couple of consecutive summers at setting up the Croke Park date. He's going to have to try again. Maybe he'll have the Saudis at his back this time to kind of bankroll the thing, make up for some sort of financial shortfall, which he perceives to be there when you're booking Croke Park. It's so expensive, he says, compared to Wembley Stadium. Maybe they feel that Saudi Arabia will be able to make the shortfall up.
Mm. Realistically, do you expect to ever see her fight at Croke Park?
I don't know. I've been burned on this before. Yeah. I would have said that I thought last year or maybe even this year it would happen, just because I suppose following a rematch win over Chantel Cameron last year that dominated the post-fight press conference, and Hearn seemed so dedicated to making it happen. Katie Taylor is the boss and often usually gets what she wants, right? And she said that this is what she wanted. I thought that they couldn't deny her, and yet it didn't happen. So will it happen next year? I won't hold my breath.
Yeah.
But we can hope. I mean, it's a fitting venue for a trilogy fight between two great rivals.
Yeah, but ultimately, Hearn is a businessman. He's a multimillionaire businessman. He can make the concession of paying the rental cost if he needs to. You know, I there's two sides to this, obviously. You know, I don't necessarily agree. I don't know what your view is, Ruby. Do the GAA need to make a stance here, or should they be demanded to make a stance to reduce what's the higher of the haul cost?
I don't think you can force the GAA to say, sorry, lower your rent there so yeah. Katie Taylor can come and fight, be it that it is an iconic stadium within Ireland. But I would have said, as well as the rent in Croke Park, to make this pay for Eddie Hearn, for Amanda Serrano, for Katie Taylor, you need Netflix. Did Netflix want to come to Dublin, or does Las Vegas suit Netflix better? I know where my favourite would be.
How did the whole Netflix experiment in boxing work for you, Kevin?
In reality, it was pretty horrendous, I suppose. Like, the main event was a disgrace to the sport, and they backed it. They demanded it, effectively. They were in negotiations with Jake Paul, and, we're gonna back you and your company. You can put on, you know, because they could have a long-term deal here, which would be beneficial for the sport. But once Jake Paul threw out Mike Tyson's name, you know, they wet their pants in excitement, and all of a sudden we had this absolute farce of a main event. But I suppose some friendly fire was the fact that Taylor and Serrano epic rematch took place on Netflix. They broke the internet, right, out of just sheer demand. It was almost impossible to watch the Taylor versus Serrano fight live on Netflix. It was buffering so much, and same with the main event. Most people who watched it the following day back in Ireland. And there was no such problems. But if you're trying to watch that fight live, it was really difficult. Hopefully an issue that if they continue, you know, streaming live sports, that they'll fix. And I suppose it speaks to the success of the event. I mean, they said afterwards that 50 million households watched the Taylor versus Serrano rematch, which would make it the most watched women's sporting event of all time. Like, because 50 million households could point to 100 million viewers, right? There's not just one person watching in a household. So a phenomenal success. The actual experience of watching the bouts, I felt that their commentary was extremely biased and it coloured people's views of the fight. But I wouldn't want to patronise either. You know, people know what they're watching and people are entitled to their own views as well.
Yeah, but it is a game changer if they can make the technology work.
Yeah, like the amount of people that they can appeal to and they can bring an audience to, yeah, it's absolutely enormous. The interest in this fight was so big. I think if they had any involvement with a third fight, yeah, it's gangbusters, really. But there is a potential problem there. Like, Eddie Hearn is Katie Taylor's promoter. Jake Paul is Amanda Serrano's promoter. They're going to court, I think, you know, over defamation. And they're kind of mortal enemies at this stage. So could I see them putting on a co-promotion at Croke Park? Look, sometimes people put their differences aside for money, right? You know, yeah, so listen, maybe that's the sort of thing.
How many people did Don King fall out with over the years, and then all of a sudden he was up on a podium with them? So money talks. And...
Well, just look right now, like Frank Warren, the two preeminent British promoters of their day are Frank Warren and Eddie Hearn. They were never even in the same room, despite being like rivals for 10, 20 years. They're suddenly holding hands now because the Saudis have brought them into the room together and they're paying them both. Mm. So they're suddenly their best friends, you know. So
they most certainly are. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We're running out of time with a busy show, Kevin. But I think the biggest drawback for Croke Park will be that Netflix will want it at about 4 a.m. to suit an American audience in Croke Park. Just can't see the locals having that.
It's definitely not going to be the case. Kevin Byrne from The Sunwood is there. We are going to press on and hear from the Irish scrum coach, John Fogarty, after the break. Stay with us.
Game on.
Rugby.
And you're welcome back to the programme. So after defeat to New Zealand and victory against Argentina last weekend, Ireland face Fiji this Saturday at 3:10 in match 3 of their Autumn Nations series, looking to secure back-to-back wins after that initial defeat. Now, one hallmark of the opening two games has been the number of penalties that Ireland have been conceding. 13 in each game, and basically the advantage that is giving some of the best teams in the world the prospect to keep the scoreboard ticking over and put Ireland under pressure. Big talking point for Andy Farrell after the opening two games, and likewise an awful lot of the players. And again today with the Irish scrum coach John Fogarty, who was on media duty and has been looking forward to Saturday's game in the company of Michael Corcoran.
Can I talk to you about the discipline? Because it appears as if it's, I don't know, is it a mental thing or otherwise, but we seem to have fallen on the wrong side in both matches with a high penalty count, and that's very kind of unlike Ireland. But people tell me it's within your control, so why can't we control it, if you understand?
Yeah, it is unlike Ireland. We've had a great track record. We're one of the most disciplined sides, I reckon, over the last 10 years. So, it's a frustration across the board, isn't it? But lads are very, very aware. I spoke inside about getting ahead of the game. Mm. And, you know, again, it comes on the back of clarity in your mind. And when you're ahead of the game, you're not late to rooks. You're aware of the offside line and bits and pieces like that. So I think it's really important this week we're getting ahead of the game so that we can be ahead of all those decisions. So, again, very aware as a playing group. Coaches are very aware. So yeah, we'll see you at the weekend.
The thing about it, John, is what struck me about everybody over the last number of years, like you're so critical of yourselves, if you understand. You don't need to listen to outside noise because there's quite a lot of it there, but you're so critical of yourselves and your own performances on the pitch.
I think we don't shy away from the reality of the game, reality of whatever happens during a game. I think that the lads are vulnerable enough with each other that they can have proper conversations, and a lot of that's been developed over the last number of years. We get to the root of problems as quickly as possible so that we can deal to them. It's been good. There's been some real conversations over the last couple of weeks, and there's an excitement within the group to put a performance that the people of Ireland can be proud of and that we can be proud of. So we're looking forward to the weekend.
That's John Fogarty chatting today. Neil Tracy, Ruby. Neil, who loves a stat. I don't know if you've ever talked about rugby stats with Neil. He just goes into his own.
Yes, we have.
So in advance of the Argentina game, Ireland had conceded 47 points between the New Zealand game and the South African game, which preceded it. 42 of those 47 points had come from penalties we'd conceded. 15 penalties given away, 14 had been kicked successfully. So listen, the Heineken drinking lads who sit at the bar will tell you, if you're over 10 penalties in a game, you're in serious trouble. I think Joe Smith used to want Ireland to be around 7. So it's kind of that thing that people have caught on to. But when you start to look at the stats and look at the facts and figures, you can kind of see why it's so important.
You can. And also, there was a, I'm sure it was Neil I was reading as well, about Ireland's point scoring in the second half being incredibly low.
Yeah.
Which that is, probably needs to be addressed too.
Yeah. But listen, once you come out on top,
do you start like, fast and try and hang on?
It's like you when you were, you know, winning all the races you were winning. Once you were leading at the line, that's the only place it worried where you were leading or not.
It's the only place it ever played to be in front, Damien.
That's it. Come here, busy couple of days of racing in advance. The Winter Festival of Punchestown. Quality card.
It will be great racing. Good card on Saturday, the Morgiana Hurdle, which has been moved from the Sunday slot into the Saturday now, is on Saturday afternoon at 2:10. 5-day entry this afternoon. I'd be shocked if Ballyburn was to stay over hurdles myself. I could see him going over fences. But Willie Mullins has left in state man and lost him out. Gordon Elliott has brighter days ahead. He was a really good, impressive winner at Down Royal when she beat King at Kingsfield. She was unlucky in her only defeat, Damien, last year at the Cheltenham Festival when she was beaten by Golden Ace, but it looks like she's going to take on whatever Willie Mullins chooses to run, be that state man, lost him out. He'd probably run Sir Gerhard as well, and that looks an interesting race on Saturday afternoon. Of course, it's the big race in Ireland, but Saturday's big race in the UK is the Betfair Chase at Haydock. And that looks an interesting contest too. Dan Skelton has Grey Dawning, who won the JLT Novice Chase at Cheltenham Festival last year. And he looks like taking on a High Senior, who has run eye-catchingly in the Old Rowan Chase. You've Royal Pagai, who was last year's winner. Willie Mullins has supplemented Capitano into the race when his Corbett's Cross came out. Hewick is in there, the real whacker. And a really interesting French runner called Gold Tweet for Gabrielle Leenders. Gabrielle won the cross-country race in Cheltenham last Friday, but this fellow won the Cleve Hurdle not that long ago in a run at Cheltenham, and he's an interesting runner of offences.
So that's Saturday. John Durkin Sunday?
John Durkin Sunday looks to be a cracker, and it will be a real cracker. You'll have last year's Cheltenham Gold Cup winner versus his Punchestown Gold Cup winner, Nemesis Fast or Slow. They both look like they're going to take their chance, along with last season's top novice Factophile for Willie Mullins, who of course won the Brown Advisory at the Cheltenham Festival. It looks like making his seasonal debut. You'll have Grange Clare West, I Know the Way You're Thinking, maybe Spillane's Tower. The John Durkin was moved last year from the 8th of December, Damien, to the end of November to allow the likes of Galloping the Sean Fast or Slow all to reappear and run at Christmas. It was a great move from Punchestown and Horse Racing Ireland to move it forward a fortnight. People, when you go horse racing, you want to see the big names and you want to see them as often as you can. So moving to John Durkin looks like it's been a brilliant idea, and it looks like it's been a cracking renewal this Sunday again.
You know, people talk about racing at this time of the year, and everything is a marker for Cheltenham and a marker for what's to come months down the line. Like the big story today, like Constitution Hill and how strong Constitution Hill's workout has been ahead of, is it a return with the Fighting Fifth the weekend after this?
Yeah,
and then obviously the Champion Hurdle at Cheltenham. And like, I'm always a bit bemused by the horse theoretically didn't have a great run out this morning, and all of a sudden there's massive movement in markets around races that don't take place until St. Patrick's Day or St. Paddy's weekend.
It's crazy, but X, as you call it now, not Twitter anymore, went into overdrive this morning with Constitution Hill's work at Newbury. Like, it's a training day. It's in a way a training day. It's no different than the Irish rugby team, I suppose, going to Portugal for a camp or having a training day at the Aviva Stadium. It is training, but if you don't watch them training every day, it's hard to know how to train.
Yeah.
It's not
and ultimately, Nico de Bonneville and Nicky Henderson realistically are the people who know what was being demanded of the horse. Whereas you have a whole lot of rubberneckers are watching it, trying to analyse everything, completely oblivious as to what the in-house tactics are. Or am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. He worked with a horse called Sergino, who's a very good horse. But we were in Willie Mullins' this morning and the videos circulated and we were laughing, because had you watched Hurricane Fly train in his second last season, now he didn't win a Champion Hurdle in his last season, but if you'd watched him train in his second last season, you'd never have thought that he'd win a Champion Hurdle. Yet he did. Just as he got older, he got a bit more workmanlike at home, and he saved it for race day. Horses are no different to humans. They do get a bit aged and do get a bit clever.
And hypothetically, you know, not that you ever would have done this, but surely, you know, jockeys have situations where you know the eyes of the world and all these peeping Toms are there watching everything you do, and you can have a bit of crack with it yourself, because ultimately, you know what's really been asked.
There's one bigger thing, Damien. there's no prize money in a training session.
Yeah.
You don't have to win the training. You only have to win the match. And I wasn't. We did have a giggle at it. And look, it but that's it. I suppose it creates conversation, it creates debate. But and I can see people say, oh, it all revolves around Cheltenham. It doesn't if you're in the sport. This weekend's a big weekend. Morgiana, John Durkin, Betfair. Next weekend, you'll have the Coral Gold Cup at Newbury in the Fighting Fifth in Newcastle. You'll have Hatton's Grace, Strinmore, Royal Bond and Fairy House. Like, there's brilliant weekends all the way from now until Christmas. And even, it's one of those lucky years where even Thurles' last meeting before Christmas falls on the 22nd, Sunday of Christmas week. Like, that'll be a Beano day in Thurles, which would never get a mention. But there is great racing every weekend from now till Christmas. But and
the problem is, Cheltenham has become one of these things that, like, it now transcends racing. And it's this notional thing that's on the distance in five months' time. And people are losing their lives over it, you know?
I know, but that's a bit like the Southern Hemisphere. They're planning for the World Cup in 4 years' time, and we're wondering, should we be concentrating on the Six Nations? That was the conversation at the top of the show.
Should we start Sam Prendergast at 10 on Saturday? Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's everyone, whatever it is about sport, people just always keep looking further forward than they have to. And sometimes the obvious answers are right in front of you.
Okay, right. Let's finish the programme with a man who's bound to have loads of Cheltenham tips for us already. Mark Langdon from the Racing Post is with us. Hiya, Mark. Oh, hang on now.
Don't wait, Damon.
Ruby, you talk amongst yourselves for a second. I just have to press a button or two here.
Don't worry, you work it out. I know if I had to press the buttons, you'd be here for more than a minute or two. So yeah. I most definitely am going to slag for that. But
yeah,
but Punchestown are running a brilliant competition too at the weekend. There's a family prize on offer. I thought this was a real good marketing ploy to get the younger people of Kildare to go. There's a family trip to Lapland to be won for some lucky family.
Yeah.
At Punchestown at the weekend, so.
Because we all know
doing nothing, get in the area.
We all know Santa loves his racing. Right, take two. No one will have noticed the fact I hadn't pressed the button. Mark Langdon, good evening.
Good evening. I've just given you all the winners.
Oh, have you?
The Cheltenham Festival. Jeez, so,
listen, I missed them all because of me snapshot. You know, these the technological things that nobody needs
to
know.
We have no issue, Mark, if you want to repeat them. We're still full of ears.
I think once was enough. There'll be much better judges than me between now and the festival that can put you onto a few.
Does Cheltenham come up in conversation in England as early? Like, people are talking about it now. Does it come up in conversation this early in England, or are we obsessed to a different level?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, in terms of, you know, obviously the racing community or supporters in England, it's harder for it to sort of make a noise in the mainstream. I think Ireland's love of racing is clear, and particularly, say, National Hunt. But those that sort of enjoy racing are talking about Cheltenham, you know, almost as soon as kind of that flat season, you know, reaches, I don't know, sort of August, September time, people are talking about Cheltenham.
Okay.
It wears me down a bit, but we have to also enjoy it as well.
Not half as much as it wears Ruby down when he's asked about it constantly. Anyway, listen, we have you on to chat soccer. We obviously had the end of the Lee Carsley reign. We might talk about that in a second. Thomas Tuchel obviously has been studying these games from a English perspective forensically. And I wonder, is he wondering if there's a Harry Kane-shaped hole or problem that's going to face him when he officially takes up the gig?
Yeah, I'd say more people are talking about Harry Kane than they are Cheltenham in England right now. There's a lot of debate as to Harry Kane sort of ability to be able to lead the line for England. Against Ireland, he didn't play well for that first half, and the team struggled as a consequence. But then was one moment that changed the entire game that was down to his brilliance. That pass through to Bellingham that won the penalty, got the sending off. He then scores the penalty, and the rest of the game becomes comfortable for England. Thomas Tuchel absolutely loves Harry Kane. He tried to buy him when he was Chelsea manager. He managed to buy him when he was the Bayern Munich manager. I think there were some people at Bayern that weren't comfortable paying that type of money for a striker that was in his 30s and maybe didn't have any kind of resale value. But Thomas Tuchel managed to sort of win that battle. And I think he'll still play Kane and will build the team around him. But there's a lot of people now that just wondering with Kane's fitness whether he'll be able to play at the kind of levels required in the US, Mexico and Canada sort of in the summer of 26 when the weather is going to be hot and, you know, it's another, you know, sort of, I think, for Tuchel, he might just have to change the way he maybe wants to play. They wouldn't be able to press with Harry Kane up front the way that they would if Watkins or Solanke was leading the line.
No, they most certainly would. Northern Ireland got a draw last night with Luxembourg to top their group in the Nations League, which was a pretty good result for them, I would have thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Northern Ireland can really build on this Nations League campaign. You know, would have hoped to have finished it off with the victory. But I think as far as Northern Ireland are concerned, a lot of younger players in O'Neill's squad, they look like they're kind of building towards something again. There was, you know, a really dry spell, you know, just the, before this. But now you can start to see what they're trying to do. And I think the Nations League has, you know, really kind of lifted spirits, and it would be the same for Wales as well. So I mean, there's a couple of nations there that have actually used the Nations League as a springboard going into the, you know, what's about to be a really important time when the World Cup qualifiers. The draw is next month, so not long now to find out who everybody gets. And Northern Ireland are probably looking at it now with more optimism than they would have done, say, 18 months ago.
Well, for Wales top their group, they have to beat Iceland tonight and hope Montenegro can beat Turkey. How likely are those two results?
I think they'll do their part, Wales. I think Turkey will probably get the job done. But even if Wales end up in the playoff, I think that they can consider that a successful campaign. Bellamy has lifted the morale. They're playing better football. You know, again, what I was just saying there with Northern Ireland, Wales look like they've now got something to be really hopeful for the future. So I expect them to at least do their part, but it might not be enough to top the group. But they probably would have settled for second at the start. Turkey were the standout team, I think, in the group. And Wales have played well in the two matches against them. So might even be a little bit of frustration that they haven't managed to get their noses in front.
Ruben Amorim took his first training session this morning for Manchester United, and there circulated videos on social media. Marcus Rashford was positive about the impact. Have you seen them, or what's the story in England?
Yeah, I think that there is this kind of belief and hope that Ruben Amorim can get the best out of players that maybe Erik ten Hag couldn't. Rashford would be one. Mason Mount, when he's fit, I mean, he's just, you know, forgotten man, really, in that Manchester United midfield. And the hope is that, you know, a coach with a structure can just get these individuals to play better, both for themselves but also for the team. I would be hopeful that Amorim could do that. Against that, I think most people, and myself included, felt that Erik ten Hag could do that, or Louis van Gaal, or, you know, any of the other managers that Manchester United have appointed since Ferguson left. So, you know, Amorim, I think, will be given a bit of time, and there's less pressure on him, because I think expectations are about as low as they could be for Manchester United. And that's not to say that they're low, but, you know, he'll get the time. And I think he's definitely got something about him that makes him, I think, stand out, that, you know, he might be the one that can lift United, if not to the Premier League title, at least back to, you know, more respectable levels than what we saw under Ten Hag at times.
Mark, before we let you go, Lee Carsley obviously finished up his time in charge of England. An 83.3% win rate leaves him behind Sam Allardyce's perfect 100%. But how will Carsley's time in charge be remembered, if it'll be remembered at all? And where does he go from here, presuming his tenure with the 21s will end at some stage?
Yeah, I mean, how will he? I think you're right to say that he probably won't be remembered. You know, if Tuchel does well, nobody's going to remember winning Nations League Group B or whatever it was. But I think that what we've seen from sort of Tuchel, actually, from Lee Carsley, is that he's given Tuchel many options. You know, the amount of debuts he's given players, that might be his legacy. Who knows if Gomez in midfield could go on and develop. Curtis Jones was another one. You know, so Anthony Gordon suddenly starts playing on the left-hand side of midfield on a more regular basis. So that might be Lee Carsley's legacy. In terms of where he goes, I think it'll be somewhere, if it is to be in club football, I think it'll be somewhere out of the spotlight. He looked really uncomfortable, you know, being sort of facing up to journalists. So I think he would just want to either be a coach or to manage somewhere that's not quite in the spotlight like it was for England. He was linked, wasn't he, with the Coventry job at one stage. I would say that the under-21s, I think, is great for him. It's just whether he now thinks he's kind of outgrown that position himself. I'd like to see him stay as the under-21 coach because he believes in young players, he plays good football, and there isn't that media glare and spotlight like you have to face when you take on one of those bigger jobs.
Well, wherever he goes, I hope he is successful. Mark Langdon, thank you very much for taking our call. That is all we have time for. A big thanks to Damien O'Mara for co-hosting with me tonight, to Laura Lee Davis and to Ronan Lawler. Marie Crowe will be back at you tomorrow night on Game On. Enjoy the rest of your evening.